On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we spend quite a bit of time dissecting the free agency of Munetaka Murakami. He has 1 week to ink a contract with a big league team, and we have heard crickets. Nothing but crickets. Why is that the case? What teams are fits? We'll chat about all that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that once gifted and received Baltimore Orioles-themed Russian nesting dolls for Hanukkah. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And what better way to celebrate the Festival of Lights?
What weirdo got you those?
I don't know.
One of my favorite gifts I have ever tracked down and purchased for my pal Jacob. Good morning, Jake. It's Tuesday. It's December 16th, and we have a whole bunch of transactions to talk about. But funny enough, we are going to begin this Tuesday show with a transaction that has yet to occur, and that is our opener.
In life, deadlines are everywhere. Pay your rent. Send in this assignment. Get married on this day. In baseball, however, there are way fewer dates where something must be done by. Yes, we have the trade deadline, after which point no teams may swap players henceforth. Yes, we have certain notches in the calendar that encourage or incentivize certain movement. You know, we got the 40-man roster deadline, the non-tender deadline, all that other stuff. But when it comes to free agency, there really aren't many deadlines. And over the years, we have had free agencies drag into the early spring. But something that is quite refreshing about the influx of NPB Japanese talent here into Major League Baseball is that these players, when they come over, have deadlines. They must sign by a certain date after their posting. Now, what does that mean right now? It means that Munetaka Murakami, the most compelling player available coming over from Japan, has a week left. He must sign by this time next week. And yet, we, the baseball-consuming public, have heard bupkis, nothing, bizarrely little about a player that means so much to so many and has the potential to either elevate or completely derail a Major League Baseball team, depending on how he performs. Jordan, as you mentioned, it is Tuesday, December 16th. What is the exact time and date by which Mr. Murakami must sign? And why do you think we've heard nothing?
Yeah, so 5 p.m. Eastern on the 22nd. So that's next Monday. And that's why we wanted to have this conversation now. I do expect us to get a little bit more substantial reporting over the course of this week in terms of where we're at with Murakami. As for why we haven't heard anything, I think one factor that we've mentioned that is certainly as we compare it to recent free agencies of Japanese stars is that he's represented by Excel. Casey Close, who's at kind of the top of that agency. Excel has, of course, several of the best players in MLB, including this offseason with Kyle Tucker and Kyle Schwarber and a few others. But they have not historically represented any of the... yes. I don't think he's going to start going by Kyle. But they have not historically represented some of the top Japanese players. That has predominantly been, at least in recent years, Wasserman, which is Joel Wolf. That's what we got with Roki Sasaki, but also Yamamoto. Scott Boras, of course, has represented a handful of these, including this offseason with Tatsuya Imai and Kazuma Okamoto. And then, of course, you know, in Ohtani's case, that was very much a Nez Bolello venture. He had been with Nez of CAA. That was kind of a one-off. But for the most part, it's been a lot of Wasserman, a lot of Boras. Every agency handles free agency differently, particularly in how much information they kind of let get out. As we know, there are some agencies that don't mind telling reporters a lot of stuff and kind of keeping people updated, as we saw last year with Roki. Now, Roki was a very unique situation because it wasn't a normal free agency whatsoever, because he was technically a amateur, so it wasn't like an all-out bidding war, and Joel Wolf was very transparent about it. But
as we see when Scott Boras does a freaking press conference at the winter meetings, right? Like, he wants to be out there and he wants the players to be talked about. Casey Close and Excel kind of do the exact opposite, right? You could line up, and maybe this makes me bad at my job, I think you could line up three white dudes over the age of 50 and be like, Jake, which one is Casey Close? And I'm not sure I could do it, right? Whereas for most of the other top agents in the game, I could do it, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is indicative. You know, we have also heard very little about Kyle Tucker. And I think Excel, just as a organizational strategy, keeps things locked down. They are the Atlanta Braves of agencies. And as that pertains to Murakami, right? Like, typically with a Japanese player, we get news of visits or meetings or preferences. And we have gotten none of that. And with a week to go, as the clock ticks down, we are basically in the exact same space we were when he was posted from a public information perspective.
That said, let's not overrate that side of things too much, because I think what's really happening here is more so related to Murakami, the player, and what teams are contemplating investing in. So I think that we should review that part, because that is really what makes him so unique, because you have these massive pros of why someone would want to give this guy a ton of money.
Sure.
One of which is age. There are not free agents that are becoming available who are 25. He turns 26 in February. That is not normally when you have access to a free agent. As we saw, that was a huge part of why Yamamoto got so much money and such a long deals, because of when he was hitting the market. But also, this is a very accomplished hitter in Japan. Someone who at his peak was as dominant as we've really seen any hitter in that league.
Yeah.
Now, that was a few years ago. That was, you know, 2022 was really the peak of that. And since then, he has been merely very good and has also dealt with some injuries. But it does seem that that trajectory, along with the profile of hitter that he is and the defensive limitations, which you can talk about, has made him extremely polarizing. Obviously, when we had our pal Yuri on, he described it very well and why he's been polarizing, not just in an MLB free agent context, but he's been polarizing in Japan as well in terms of just like where he's viewed. But I do think that right now teams are kind of, if this is going to be their big expenditure, that is a big decision. And I have to imagine from the agency side, they are maybe at the point now, as the deadline draws closer, maybe having to consider like, okay, maybe an 8 or 9 year deal with $200 million that we maybe thought he was heading towards a few years ago is not there. Do we have to get creative? And maybe we use the age in a way where it's like, all right, maybe we do something that's more short term. Go prove yourself. Go hit 40 homers in MLB, opt out. And now you really cash in because you've proved it to all the teams that doubted you. Well, but let's talk about why teams are doubting him, because I do think that that's probably what's making this a little bit more of a difficult decision.
Yeah, there are two main detriments, two main demerits here for Murakami, the player. One is defense. And I actually want to start there. If Murakami was a good defender and a good, for lack of a better term, defensive athlete, I think teams would be more comfortable. He's not a great mover. He's not a great bender, right? He's not particularly agile side to side. And even though he has, over the years, been billed as a third baseman, my general understanding from talking to people around the game, scouts, international directors, you know, coaches, people that have watched film, is that he's almost certainly ending up at first base or DH in the very near future. Here's an example. Jordan, do you know how hard it is to find Munetaka Murakami defensive highlights online? Like, I can't do that, right? There's like video of him taking warm-up ground balls and not much else. And so it's difficult for me to make my own evaluation, but you can just watch the guy move and see how he's built and deduce that there are simply not people at the hot corner that look like that, right? Or move like that. Devers, who has been pushed across the diamond, the general understanding is Devers is better than Murakami defensively. Does the team maybe give him a shot at third? Maybe. Some will be more likely than others. I think he'll be a first base DH type. Now, that's worth it for a certain kind of special bat, right? The biggest issue with his offensive profile, though, is the amount of in-zone swing and miss. And this is a really important distinction. He is not chasing. This is not a Javi Baez problem, right? Where you can bounce the ball in the other batter's box and he's going to swing at it. He's actually got a very good eye. He won't expand the zone that much. He has a good walk rate. But if you throw pitches in the zone against him, he will swing and miss. For context, over the last number of years, he's running a zone contact rate in the low 70s. All right? That is, just to be clear, pitches thrown in the strike zone, how often is he making contact with them? He's in the low 70s. Last year, okay, just six hitters were under 80. And he's in the low 70s. Just one hitter, who happens to be Devers, was under 75, right? And I think that does make Devers a very interesting comp when you dig into the numbers of the profile, right? Where it's all fields power and the swing kind of looks similar where the bat lags behind, but he's able to whip through. But that scares teams off because if you're running a low 70s in zone contact rate in NPB, where there's not that much, you know, elite stuff, and you're coming over to the bigs, I mean, you might get your doors blown in. Now, all of the data about how he fares against elite velocity, I think, is super skewed because of the small sample size there. He's just not seeing enough of that in Japan to make a real assessment. But, like, I have tons of concerns about the end zone swing and miss. And now my last point here before I kick it back to you. I just think it's worth putting him within the spectrum of players that we've seen come over from Japan, right? For a long while, we were getting finished products or relatively finished products. Guys in their late 20s, early 30s, where the developmental cement was relatively dry. And you felt more comfortable making the investment because you knew what the player was and you didn't need to project how they would fit and learn necessarily in your system, right? Like Darvish, in my mind, I know he's developed a lot, but you're like signing you Darvish. You're like, that guy throws a bunch of nasty pitches. He's going to be the number two in my rotation right now. Then over the last couple of years, we've gotten like Roki and Ohtani were very different, but those guys were worth taking the risk on because the investment up front was so minimal. Because they were international free agents, you're only putting in like it's peanuts, right? And so if Roki Sasaki is nothing, every single team in the bigs can take that risk. What Murakami represents is, in a way, the worst of both worlds, where in order to take the chance on him, you need to put in a lot of capital, but the player that he is right now cannot be successful in the bigs, right? And in my mind, the best comp for him is really Masataka Yoshida. And now it's different, right? Yoshida, the question was, can he hit for power? Can the Red Sox add juice to the bat? Similarly, defensively limited, right? DH outfield corner turned out to be terrible defensively, has not added power. Now, there are some other things going on there. Murakami's a better player, better power, whatever. But like, that's why I think he falls into this really interesting middle ground where if you want to have this guy on your team, you need to put in a lot of money, but you also are going to need to put in a lot of developmental time and effort in a way that you probably wouldn't have to with, you know, when Seiya Suzuki came over with, you know, even Tatsuya Imai or Yamamoto. I've talked now for a long time. Those are like literally all my thoughts on Murakami. I'm curious how you would evaluate my last point there about how he fits into the trajectory of players coming over.
Well, I think first, like, the hitter pitcher difference is just enormous. And so, like,
yeah,
we've certainly just seen more pitchers come over and have success. And just, I think it's just a different conversation. Yoshida is an interesting one because, in some ways, his skill set, you were buying the floor more so. And in some ways, that's actually been validated. I mean, you look at Yoshida, yes, now he's cast off as this kind of albatross on the Red Sox roster. I think that has as much to do with the Red Sox roster as it does him himself. He's been an average hitter when he's played. It's just the upside has not really been there with him because he's been so limited in other ways. Suzuki, you know, we've seen some other guys that have obviously really flopped, but they didn't necessarily have the hype and the upside of Tsutsugo and Akiyama. And I think that that's what's really hard. The two things I would maybe push back a little bit on, not even push back, but I just think that we should maintain perspective is, one, we really don't know how much money we're talking about right now. We don't know what the investment is going to be. I think, as I said, if we're assuming that it's going to get to 200, there's a big difference in a $200 million and a $100 million investment. Because I think the most relevant part is not even necessarily the big number that we're talking about, the overall number. It's how much of your payroll are you investing in the short term, right? How much AAV are you investing in a player that you're really going to be working on that you might not even be able to count on right away? That's the question, because if you're paying that guy $30 million is probably completely untenable for almost any major league team right now, considering the risk. But let's not forget about the upside here, because if this dude makes the adjustments, this is not a player you're going to normally have access to. And you can't just pretend like that's not there too. There's clearly risk involved, but the reward is there too. And I think that there are going to be enough teams that are willing to drive the price up to something fairly compelling. That said, the point about the defense is important because you're just shrinking the number of teams that can plausibly put him on the roster right now and have him get the playing time that he needs. And so that's where that point becomes the most important when we're about to get into what teams could possibly be considering this right now and how few teams we've heard connected to him is when you get rid of a full position, you're taking out a bunch of teams that could plausibly consider him. And then first base and DH is its own challenge because so many teams have entrenched pieces. And also a lot of teams don't want to just give away their DH spot to one player. That's also just a modern reality that there are very few teams that are like, yes, you are a DH. And he's with the risk that he comes with. I'm not sure there's that many that say, yes, you are our DH, because that is the kind of backfire that could work. But again, you have to balance the pros and the cons for all of it. So let's get to the teams. I think that that's kind of what I'm focusing on this week, is just trying to, even though we've had so little reporting connecting teams to him, you can sort of start to piece it out. I know John Morosi did have a report. I think this was on MLB Network where he listed a bunch of teams. He listed Red Sox, Mariners, Tigers, Phillies, Mets, Blue Jays, Pirates. I think that like some of those have probably already changed over the last few weeks, considering who they've added. I think the Phillies are certainly one of them. I think the Blue Jays are certainly one of them. That's a little bit harder to see based on their other pursuits. But again, we could go through all 30 teams and just cross them out. I kind of want to just focus on the ones that you can look at and be like, okay, I think I could see that. So what teams stand out in that regard to you?
I do think it is quickly worth crossing out the teams you would assume to be interested that are probably not for various reasons, right? So the Dodgers are the obvious one. The Dodgers over the last two winters have signed Yamamoto, Sasaki, and Ohtani, making them this behemoth in Japan. But because of how their roster is constructed, they're just not a fit for Murakami. Max Muncy is at third base. Freddie Freeman's at first. And Shohei Ohtani's DHing. Now, I assume you could like trade Max Muncy and sign Murakami, but that doesn't really feel like it's going to happen. And then the Blue Jays, another team that have like, they have tried to be involved in Japan. They keep finishing second to the Dodgers. They have Vlad at first, and they have George Springer at DH. And so it's really difficult to see him going to either of those teams where, like, if he was a center fielder, right, I would be like, that those two teams are going to duke it out again, right? And that's why the positional side of things here is so important. It's so important. But the teams to really zoom in on, Mets, Red Sox, Angels, Tigers, Pirates. Anyone else?
Padres. I think Padres. Tigers is a tough one. I mean, again, you just have to focus on the depth charts. You know, there's other teams that I mentioned earlier, right? Like Phillies, Cubs is hard to see based on the roster. I mean, Cubs have a, I think DH is pretty open for the Cubs too, but like that's not a team that's looking like they're going to win any bidding wars anytime soon. So I'm going to move them to the side. Yankees is another one. Let's just kind of move to the side. I personally just think with Stanton still entrenched at DH, I think they really want Ben Rice to just be the first baseman. I don't think he's going to suddenly start being the catcher all the time. Third base, again, we're not really considering that a real option. So of the teams that we're considering that we think could spend a sizable amount of money, even if it's not $200 million, even if it's $100 million, let's talk about Boston, right? So Boston is one of the few teams that has not signed any free agent yet. They've made a bunch of trades. We'll get to one of those later on, but a lot of stuff involving pitching so far. They have not brought Bregman back. So third base remains a massive hole. Second base arguably is also a hole for them, that it feels like Marcelo Meyer will probably cover which of second base and third base they don't address. We will see there. First base is this mystery box that is Tristan Casas coming back from injury. And how much the Red Sox really believe in Tristan Casas is one of the great, I think, questions that we have at this stage for any team. And then at DH, they technically still have Yoshida, but then they also have all these other outfielders that they have too many of that they're trying to trade. So in some ways, you can see that they could make a big swing, especially as a pivot if they lose Bregman and if they don't believe in Casas and if they can somehow get rid of Yoshida, which, I don't think they're going to. But also, is Boston going to win the bidding war in the next week? This is another thing. Remember, Bregman ultimately fell in their lap at the end of the offseason last year. It's not like they went out in November and made the best offer. So Boston is a tough one for me to really see.
And it feels like they're not going to sign Murakami and Bregman. And based upon the way the Red Sox have operated, you have to feel like in a week when Casey Close says, hey, last chance, and Bregman's still out there, they'll pass on Murakami to give themselves the best chance to sign Bregman, right? Now, maybe it goes another way, but like, if you're asking me how I think it'll play out, I feel like that's got to be the answer, right? Like,
well, this is where Mr. Scobo comes into play, right? Because if you're Boris and you got Bregman and Bellinger, like, why are you rushing to sign this week? If you know that one of these teams that misses out is about to get a lot more desperate after the fact.
Yeah.
But there's a lot, whatever. This,
If you're the Red Sox, you're calling Boris, you're like, hey, Murakami's done next week. Can we like try and get something done like quickly? Boris is like, no. No.
So anyway, so we'll see about that. And then I think let's finish with the Mets. Okay. So let's just run through some of these other teams. So Detroit, it's like, well, why are they going to win a bidding war? I don't know. I mean, this would be extremely out of character. They would obviously want to be doing something very different. Their first base situation is Torque. The third base, they have like six guys competing. DH, Kerry Carpenter, even if maybe they're playing him in right field. Okay, we can move on from Detroit.
I don't think that's happening.
Be one where it's like I can see it on the roster if Carpenter is, if they're trying to do something different. If Scott Harris is really focused on the age of a free agent, the window, if you're buying the upside of a Murakami and like this next, you know, era of Tigers baseball, maybe you could see it again.
The reason why it doesn't make sense is because if you're the Tigers and you're going to spend money on a free agent, you need to spend money on a free agent that you're feeling really good about giving you value in 2026 in the last year of Tarek Skubal.
That's true.
Simple as.
That's true. The Pirates, it's like, well, they obviously could use any good hitter and upside. I just don't know how they're going to spend enough to do this. Okay, maybe you're willing to give that much to Schwarber, so you have the money. I think they make a lot of sense for Okamoto if they do want to try something, if they do want to, you know, sign a Japanese hitter that could help them right away and maybe won't cost $100 million. Yeah. I think Okamoto would make more sense. But Pirates, again, not really plausible.
Jack Sawinski is not blocking anyone, respectfully.
Correct. Arizona is one that's interesting. Another one, it's like, what is their financial situation if they're trading Ketel Marte? Is that financial? Is that just to get pitching? We've seen them spend big on occasion. It's been mostly on pitching. They've extended some of their guys. Their DH, first base, third base spot is not, you know, totally settled, right?
It's Steven the hole Smith, on the roster.
It is a hole on the roster. Yeah. I like Del Castillo, Pavin Smith. These are platoon guys, right? So this would also be kind of out of nowhere, but you can at least see it, and we've at least seen them spend. So it would be a way to maybe creatively chase some upside offensively, which, again, they're obviously more focused on pitching right now. Seattle, yeah, I don't also really see if the you, fit.
Yeah. Well, just Arizona quickly. It feels like that only happens if they trade Ketel Marte away, which has been probably rumored about. It would be difficult to see them carrying both of those contracts on the roster moving forward. Seattle, probably. You mentioned... Yep. If they have the budget for one more guy, it's probably not going to be this.
Yeah, I don't think they need someone that they can count on. Again, that's why they wanted to keep Polanco, keep Naylor, chase a Brendan Donovan, who you feel like the floor is about as high as you're going to get for a position player that you're going to get. So I just don't think that they're going for that level of boom or bust. And then, okay, four more that we have to hit. Giants. Okay, so we know that the Giants have been trying to chase not just Japanese stars, but they've been trying to land big free agents. They've had some minor successes here and there. Of course, they signed Willy Adames. They trade for Devers, that huge contract. They have Chapman. We know that they are more focused on pitching. And so I don't know. And also, even within that reporting, it sounds like they're not willing to necessarily stretch to do what it takes to get Tatsuya Imai. They're... You know, defensive situation is Rafael Devers is playing first base now. Matt Chapman's at third. DH is seemingly being ready for top prospect Bryce Eldridge. Are you going, who ironically has sort of very similar concerns and pros and cons of Murakami, except he's 4 years younger. Are you going to block and, right, doesn't cost any money right now. That's... Again, if they get desperate and need to make a splash, maybe. But is that going to happen the next week? Seems unlikely. Padres, Angels, Mets are our last three teams we wanted to talk about. Angels is just like, if Artie just decides, screw it. Like, we need some buzz and we're going to outspend everyone else. There's obviously room on the roster because they're bad. And if Murakami wants, like, that's certainly a place he could go play third base, probably. And if they want to say, hey, dude, like, come develop, come figure it out under the least amount of pressure possible, that's not a bad option. Like,
because
that's really not a bad option.
For all of the Angels' incompetence, for all of their inability to develop pitching, Zach Neto's pretty good. And Shohei Ohtani worked out pretty well. And the Angels, like, it was an environment that allowed Ohtani to become Ohtani. Now, how much of that was Ohtani and how much of that was the Angels is like a book.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it did work. And like the Angels are probably just going to be hands off with him. Now, if I'm Murakami and his representatives, do I want to send him into such a volatile situation where the entire coaching staff and front office could be gone in a year? Probably not.
So that dynamic is worth considering. When I say there's fit on the roster because they're bad, I think that that's true. They have one left-handed hitter on the entire 40-man. That's Nolan Schanuel. That's still a crazy thing. But it is also worth noting that Nolan Schanuel is a first baseman and is decent. And they have this Mike Trout guy that's probably going to have to DH more than he used to. So, you know, it's not perfect. They still have Jorge Soler. Third base, whatever. So it ain't great, but Angels, okay. Mets and Padres. So Padres, these are two very different situations. These are teams that have been reported as discussing a trade because the Padres are trying to shed money and the Mets, we know, have money. But how much do the Mets want to spend money? I think that the Padres is maybe the most obvious roster fit because their lineup just falls off a cliff after the first, you know, three, four guys have a massive hole at DH. First base, how much are you really believing in Gavin Sheets? You know, it's a nice story, but he's not exactly blocking anybody. okay, third base isn't part of the equation, but first base and DH, that's one of the biggest holes of any contending team is first base DH for the Padres, okay? So if they're looking for upside offensively, if they can get creative with the contract and or move off some money, whether it's a Pivetta, whether it's a Cronenworth. Now, again, who's pitching for the Padres? I don't know. Like, that is, I just wrote my, you know, big five questions for the Padres last week, which you can go read. And I just, how they're going to figure out this pitching staff, I have no idea. But, you know, like, Preller's done crazier stuff. And if they can find a contract that works here, I don't know, man. I wouldn't totally put them aside, but that is going to require some financial maneuverings. And then for the Mets, my logic is the roster fit that clear right now? Not totally, although first base, you know, it depends on what you think of Vientos. Depends on what you think of some of these other guys that would maybe be getting DH at bats. We know, as we learned last week, Juan Soto ain't playing DH, right?
Nope.
And it's more that, like, the Mets can literally afford to try something like this. The upside for a team like the Mets, where you're not as concerned about flushing $15 million down the toilet annually.
Flushing.
There you go. Didn't mean that, but I guess I did. They're the team that could say the upside of this player working out is worth, you know, putting in the best bid, even if it is a messy thing and does not sound like something Stearns would do. And is that going to happen in the next week? But based on how the offseason has unfolded, and if Steve Cohen continues to maybe win out, maybe. And also, if you're Casey Close, you're certainly giving Steve Cohen a call. I mean, like, let's be honest, that's certainly someone you would want to convince.
I think it's the Mets. I think it's the Mets. Who is the free agent that the Mets really went for? Juan Soto. Why? When David Stearns was talking about Juan Soto, he was like, you don't get access to a player at this age on the free agent market.
Yeah, that too. Kept saying that too. That would be the part that and would I be think, Stearns-y. Yeah.
Murakami fits that. I think that it is a way for them to get a foothold, you know, to be more participatory in the Japanese market where they want to be. If you want to copy the Dodgers, this makes sense. I know they already have Senga. This is like a different level. They need a bat-first guy. I think Will Salmon wrote at The Athletic that they've started to think more about that on the roster. Vientos.
We'll get to Polanco, right?
Sure. Vientos is, just, in my mind, not a bankable solution. Not that Murakami is, but I could see them moving Vientos and or the other, you know, Acuna, Mauricio for some more pitching depth, some more pitching help. Yeah, I think if you put a airsoft to my head and said, where's he going? Think I would pick the Mets.
I would have felt way better about it before they signed Jorge Polanco. And we can talk more about that after the break. But I don't know. This is why, again, we spent a lot of time on this already. This is a big chunk here, but this is what makes it so interesting. It is really, really hard to find the place.
I just don't feel like we or anyone else in the industry has a real read on what the heck's going to happen here, both in terms of the team and the money, right? So, like, but make a prediction. Let's see how wrong we're going to be, right? I'll say Mets, like 500 with an opt after the second year.
My only prediction is, yeah, it's gonna be some sort of convoluted, almost like what we saw with the Imanaga deal, where it's like a two-way opt-out. We get a team option and player option mixed in at certain junctures.
But you only got a week. If these guys, I don't think, again, this is complete conjecture. I don't think Casey Close has started negotiating directly with teams, because I think if he has been, we would have gotten some buzz from the team side of things, right? Like, that's what happened with Schwarber. Is I don't think that all the Schwarber buzz in advance was coming from Casey Close. It was coming from the team side. And I just don't think, like, the clock is ticking. If Casey Close could pull off like an Imanaga style, you know, astrophysics E equals MC squared contract in the next week, like Zygazunt, like heck but of a show.
My point is, I think that's more likely than him finding $200 million guaranteed. And that's where this deadline is. And when we talk about, and we'll take a break here, why, you know, free agents like, well, no, we don't want a deadline for a free agency, because at some point, it probably does tilt in favor of the teams.
It does.
At some point,
it definitely does.
At some point, the teams are looking around like, wait a minute, no one wants to give this guy $100 million. Why would we? Now, again, deadlines do weird things to people. So we will see how that impacts any owners involved, how it impacts the agency. I'll say this. I don't think this ends in him going back to Japan. That would be stunning. I know people have already started, like, oh, go back and try. That doesn't do anything for him. Going back and hitting a bunch more home runs in Japan does not accomplish anything. So I still expect him to end up with an MLB team. But I actually love how little we know, not just because it gave us the first half an hour of this podcast, but because for a player that I've certainly already thought a lot about coming into this winter, it's amazing how much mystery remains. And we will see what happens. And maybe he signs with the Royals or the Marlins or the Rays or someone. And we were literally spent half an hour just completely whiffing left and right. All right. Let's take a break. When we return.
Like him. Just like him.
Stuff. What is our end zone contact rate? What do you think?
I think like on the show as podcasters or as like hitters?
I don't know. As podcasters, whatever that would mean. All right, we're going to take a break when we return. Stuff that has actually happened. We'll be right back on Baseball Podcast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Stuff has happened. A flurry of little cute short-term moves over the last 48 hours. Let's go around the league. All right, let's begin with Jorge Polanco, a gentleman who was tracking towards October legend status after ALCS Game 2. Had a quiet remainder of that series. Mariners get bounced. But he put together a very impressive 2025, and he parlays that into a two-year, $40 million deal with the New York Mets. It appears that he is going to be playing first base and DH. Second base is very much under lock now that they have acquired Marcus Semien. That's not happening. Jordan, as a Mariners enthusiast, you watched quite a bit of Jorge Polanco. What do you make of this deal?
Get your money, big guy. I mean, $20 million AAV is pretty astonishing for a player at this point in his career with his track record, which is indisputably, for as awesome as it was in October, like this is about what he was able to do in the regular season, which is cut his strikeout rate by like 15 percentage points. Now, it was elevated in 2024 because he was basically playing through an injury the entire year and was really bad in his first year in Seattle. You know, he comes back to the Mariners and is just, he's just awesome. But 29% strikeout rate in 2024, 15%, I think a career low or almost a career low in 2025. He is one of the most productive switch hitters that we've had in baseball over the last, you know, handful of seasons. 134 OPS plus, 26 homers. Like, this was a really, really impressive offensive season. All the batted ball data says, like, yes, this is a hitter to believe in. And clearly it must be if they are going to play him at first base, where he has played one inning in his life and potentially as the everyday designated hitter, which is what he essentially was for Seattle. I know he was playing a good amount of second base, which very poorly. That's another reason. Even if Semien wasn't there, I think his days as a middle infield defender are pretty much over. I think the reasons why this deal makes sense for the Mets is because it is a floor raiser. I think this is one of the bats that a lot of the opposites of the reasons why we think they would sign Murakami for the upside. I think they definitely feel like they know what they're getting, and Polanco is a hitter based on what he did this past year, because all the underlying stuff is so encouraging. What's so concerning for me in terms of this deal is Polanco, from a durability standpoint, is just not been there. I know he did just play 138 games. He was generally healthy for October. But, you know, replacing Pete Alonso's production is one thing. Replacing the fact that Pete Alonso is doesn't miss games is a whole other thing. And the risk associated with paying Jorge Polanco, even on a short-term deal, $20 million for someone who's missed as much time as he has, like, That's the thing that scares me. And it's just hard not to read this as kind of a panic pivot. It's just, is this really something that David Stearns went into the offseason thinking that he was going to do? I just have a hard time believing that. And yes, it's good that they've already addressed a hole in some respects. And I think Jorge Polanco's good, but it's a really weird one. It's a really weird first move, first response. And while the switch hitting element is nice, I still don't think this is the kind of hitter that is like the lineup protection that Juan Soto needs, or someone that you can absolutely count on to sustain this level of production. I'm that's the thing that is concerning. So I'm happy for Polanco, sure. You know, I don't know. I'm pretty surprised by this one.
I think from a production standpoint, it is a little bit too cute, and it just depends on how the rest of the winter pans out. I know that they're running out of time and options and pivots. I do think that if the Mets are prioritizing like refreshing the culture in the room, Polanco is one of the few elite like clubhouse makeup guys in the game. And people, he's been injured a bunch, right? But like super hard worker, a pro's pro. People love this dude. One of the nicest cats in the game. And I do think that is a relevant factor here.
Yeah, and I can't imagine. I mean, I saw the effect that he had on Julio. I can't imagine Juan Soto isn't like. I bet Juan Soto's pretty excited to have Jorge Polanco on his team. You know, that is a player, and if we're again, like, does Juan Soto need the help? Does Juan Soto need mentoring? Like, I don't really think so. But it's important, like, to have someone that I'm sure Juan Soto's excited to have on the team. That's not nothing, and I do think that. Based on the season that he had, it's just like based on his track record, you know, he hasn't had two good healthy seasons in a row ever. Like, it's just like not something that's in his track record. And so I hope he can do it. Obviously, the Mariners are going to have to figure out what they're doing to replace him. We'll save that for another day. It's just an interesting first step. And it certainly doesn't fix your defense. That's another thing. Maybe Jorge Polanco can learn first base and play it better than Pete Alonso right away. I don't know. Kind of doubt that. And if he's your everyday DH, like, okay. It obviously worked for Seattle, but I think the current status of this Mets lineup, I'm not sure that's exactly what they need.
All right, let's stay in division. The Phillies signing Adolis Garcia to a one-year $10 million deal. He was projected for around $12 million in arbitration with the Rangers. The Rangers decided to non-tender him, making him a free agent a little bit earlier this offseason. Garcia, most famous for his 2023 God run through the postseason on the way to Texas's first world championship in franchise history. The Phillies looking to kind of refashion their outfield, give Adolis Garcia the exact same amount that they just gave Max Kepler. Now, Garcia's offensive floor, I think, is lower than Kepler's. And I think his defensive abilities are higher. And I think that is important. The other context that is key here with the Phillies is that Nick Castellanos is gone. He is technically still on the roster. The Phillies are technically still his employer. They are going to trade him and eat the money or release him outright. If Nick Castellanos plays a game for the 2026 Philadelphia Phillies, I will bike to opening day from Washington, D.C. Jordan, what do you make of this one?
Yeah. Well, this one is super interesting to me because I know why you brought up Kepler, but from a profile standpoint, like, the things that have made Adolis Garcia one of the worst hitters in baseball over the last 2 years is kind of the same stuff as Nick Castellanos. The difference is that Garcia, as you mentioned, is a very, very good defender in right field still. So at the very least, you're getting that instead of Castellanos. And Garcia has still, like, when he's hitting the ball, he's still generally doing it with authority. But if you're looking for, like, an upgrade in on-base skills compared to Castellanos, who swings at everything, you're not really getting it. And so you're really hoping that a change of scenery kind of gets Adolis back to what he was in 2023 when it wasn't just the postseason. I mean, he was an all-star. Like, he was getting – like, it was a complete very, very good season in 2023. And since then, he started hot in 24. Since then, he's been horrible. I mean, he's been dealing with some injuries here and there, but that is a large sample of bad hitting for Adolis Garcia over the last 2 years. And we're going to see if he can kind of find something with the Phillies. You know, they're not expecting him to hit third or fourth, but it's funny that they didn't, like, profile wise, it's not going to be that different. It's just a new face and kind of a new energy.
I mean, there's upside. And there's we'll upside.
Yeah, there's clearly upside. And yeah, yes. I think that at this point, you could say there's more upside. And the floor is also higher because the defense is better.
Also, not a white American guy. I know technically Max Kepler was not that either, but
no, he was not.
But Adolis is offering it's a little bit more sauce than the rest of this roster. Royals extending Mikel Garcia, 5 years, $57.5 million with a club option, could go up to 85 depending on escalators. This buys out one free agent year. Two, if the club option gets picked up. Garcia, that's why this number looks so low, relatively. Like, if Garcia was on the open market right now, he would get way more than this. But the Royals had him under contract already. He's the second best player on the team behind Bobby Witt Jr.?
Well, yeah, that is very clear. I mean, the question is, if you look at the season he just had, you know, where is he among third basemen? At the very least, this left side of the infield is as good as you're going to see, offensively and defensively. I mean, defensively, I think it's pretty clearly the best, unless I'm forgetting someone obvious. What Bobby Witt has become as a defender and what Mikel has, he's been the whole time as a defender. Now he's become a good hitter as well. It's a no-brainer. The Royals have had a very interesting offseason. We're going to talk about the trade they made in a second. But what Garcia just did this past year, it's one of the biggest breakouts we had in terms of going from good to great. Any player in the league, he's one of the first guys you have to mention in 2025. And so I think the Royals clearly recognize that, and investing in him makes a lot of sense. Now, the problem with Kansas City, while they have, you know, have a pretty solid infield situation, you know, with our guy Vinny, Bobby Witt, and have made some big strides on the pitching side, the problem for Kansas City over the last real decade is that their outfield has been horrible. Their outfield has been
terrible,
atrocious,
terrible.
Essentially, awful. Since Alex Gordon and Lorenzo Cain were roaming the Kauffman Field grass. And they have made a trade to attempt to start to address that. We talked about how they signed Lane Thomas to a one-year deal. Well, how much can he help coming off an injury in a lost season? They make a trade with the Milwaukee Brewers to acquire Isaac Collins, another one of the shocking breakouts of 2025. In Collins' case, as a rookie, one of the many Brewers rookies to be very productive. Isaac Collins was a terrific defender in left field and got on base a ton, a switch hitter who can also play in the infield. They, of course, the Royals do not expect to need him in the infield, but that's a nice versatility. They send Angel Zerpa, left-handed reliever, to Milwaukee for Isaac Collins and Nick Mears.
Zerp dog, baby.
We've been calling him Zerp dog, but I believe it is pronounced Zerpa. But this was a head-scratcher for a lot of people who, understandably, if you were just kind of following the Brewers and best record of baseball, and you know that Isaac Collins was like in the NL Rookie of the Year race, and you say, that's it? Like, the Royals are just getting this, you know, fringe Rookie of the Year contender to fix one of their outfield spots for a reliever? That's it? And I think that there's some truth to that, and I do like this trade for Kansas City. The bar, as I've just established, for outfield production for them has been as low as you can possibly have it across baseball. And so while I don't expect Isaac Collins to have a, whatever it was like a 121 OPS plus or whatever he just did in Milwaukee, even if it's 100 or 105, that would be huge. And if he can play good defense in left field, I think the Royals would definitely take that. And it's not surprising that the Brewers look at a pitcher like Zerpa and say, oh, he's a lefty that throws 97. I bet we can make him even better. You know, just in the same way that the Mariners viewed Jose Ferrer, Zerpa's just kind of a worse version of Jose Ferrer.
But they might even try and start him. Like,
and maybe they'll try and start him. Whether they try and start him or not.
The Brewers are like having all their dudes throw three innings at a time. Like, I think they think they could stretch Serp Dog out a little bit more. It's like, you know, in Holes, you ever seen Holes? I can fix that.
I have seen Holes.
Like, with
that
the Brewers,
that is a movie
when
I've
you
seen.
See, when you look at this trade from afar, right? You're like, Mears for Serpa is like a wash. And then mm-hmm. Collins is good. Right? Right. And maybe that's right. true. Yeah. So it's like the Royals won. Maybe, and I think that's probably right. Like when the Brewers and the Royals make a trade, I'm biased to be like, well, the Brewers won the trade. Sam Miller tweet. Love this trade for the Rays. Who'd they give up? Who'd they get? The Brewers are that right now, and they probably see something we don't, and I can't wait to see what it is.
Yeah, it is just funny that, like, more specifically, not even about what they believe in Zerpa, but more like what they don't believe in Isaac Collins, right? for how special Isaac Collins was this past year, for the Brewers to be able to look at their own success stories and be like, yeah, I don't think this yeah. one's going to keep going.
Also,
it's kind of funny, former I'm sure Rockies. Isaac Collins is looking forward to, I'm sure, two former Rockies, that's true, in Collins and Nick Mears. But I do think that, like, I'm sure Isaac Collins is like, oh, okay, great. I'll just go be the everyday left fielder sure. and prove him wrong. And I would love to see that. That'd be cool.
We have a handful more transactions, and we're going too long, so let's throw the rest of these into turbo mode. Toronto Blue Jays signed Tyler Rogers, the king of the low slot jokers, for 3 years, $37 million. Pretty amazing. Tyler Rogers throws underhanded and doesn't throw harder than, what, 86? Is like his fastest pitch ever. It's a yeah. great bit and clearly replicable, and another sign that the Blue Jays are cooking this winter. Diamondbacks, Merrill Kelly, 2 years, $40 million. We had gotten buzz that Kelly wanted to go back there. He played college ball there. He'd been there forever. We'll always remember his 2 months of Rumspringa in Arlington, Texas. But he returns home to continue to be a part of the Arizona baseball community.
D-backs still rebuilding their rotation. They bring in Soroka. They're going to say, hey, we got Corbin Burns coming back. I still feel like they need to add a few more pitchers to take them seriously, but nice to see Merrill Kelly go back. Speaking of those Rangers, no, they don't get to keep Merrill Kelly, but they do bring in Danny Jansen, who is, after they non-tender Jonah Heim, big questions behind the plate for Texas. They sign Danny Jansen for 2 years, 14 and a half. They also bring in a couple relievers, Alexis Diaz and Tyler Alexander, as they try and rebuild their bullpen, which outside of Robert Garcia, basically all reach free agency.
But was really good. Like they did this last year yeah. and it kind of yeah. worked.
It's true.
Before we fly through all the 1 year deals here, Jordan and I last night went down a rabbit hole. We looked at every single one-year deal that was handed out last winter, okay? And to the position players specifically, there were 53 one-year MLB deals. And our thought was, how many of these worked out? And at a very cursory glance, without pulling up any advanced statistics, just flying through it, we determined that of those 53, there were 8 wins, 11 draws, and 35 losses, okay? 8 wins, 11 draws, 35 losses, which is important context because over the next couple of months, we will be like, that's a one-year deal for this team. That's good. Most of these don't work. If you're signing a one-year deal, there's a reason for that, right? It's because right. you're probably not good, generally speaking. Like if you said, hey, Jake, this team got a player on a one-year deal. Is it going to work? I would say no. It's not going to work. It usually doesn't work.
And so the saying goes, oh, there's no such thing as a bad one-year deal. Sure, it's not a bad deal, but is he helping a baseball team win? The odds are probably not. So let's talk about some of these. The Tigers signed Kenley Jansen, who is chasing 500 saves. He gets $11 million over 1 year. Two behind Lee Smith on the all-time list. Does he get to 500? I think probably he ain't getting to 600. So Mariano and Trevor Hoffman do not have to worry about that. Kenley Jansen will be, I assume, the closer. I assume they're promising him the closer because Kenley Jansen only cares about saves, and I think Will Vest will pitch in any inning. Shouts out
to I love that about Vest, him, by the
Yankees.
Way.
Yankees. Yes. Oh, Will Vest.
I love that Jansen. At this point in his career, Kenley Jansen is just chasing a number. Like, no 100%. Shame. That's what he's
more
doing.
More blatantly than everybody like it or else. Not. And it's great.
Yeah.
It's good. And I can do it on a good team. So we'll see how that goes. Yankees bring back Amed Rosario. You love Amed Rosario. And as far as one-year deals goes, this was one of the ones that actually worked out for the team. I guess it was the Nationals and then the Yankees last year. Maybe. Can he do it again? Can Amed Rosario have two successful one-year deals in a row? It sounds like you believe he can.
I do. The Yankees need people who hit right-handed, who play multiple positions. And he checks both of those boxes. The Cardinals signed Dustin May for 1 year and money TBD. Won't be a lot. This one, I like the shot here. This is a good shot.
I love it. I love this one. This is exactly what the Cardinals should be doing. This is, I'm like, oh, as awful as Dustin May was this past year, this is not going to cost a lot of money, I don't think. And they need new guys to throw innings. If they can get him to be competent and then trade him, like, I'm in. Love it. Good job. Good job, Cardinals. Good job, Dustin May. This next one I'm not as enthused about. Miami Marlins signed Christopher Morel for a year and $2 million to apparently play first base, which is the only position he's never played. First base has not been going awesome for the Marlins recently. That said, I don't think this is the answer. I know Christopher Morel was like pretty good a few years ago for a couple years with the Cubs. I'd love to be proven wrong here, but this is not making me encouraged about the Marlins taking the next step after their surprisingly competent season in 2025. And then finally, I guess we'd have a couple more signings that we have to do for Scobo. But one other move we did want to mention, Red Sox and Nats make a trade last night, swapping pitching prospects. Nationals get right-hander Luis Perales. Red Sox get left-hander Jake Bennett. All you need to know about this is that Luis Perales throws really hard and has huge upside and can't throw strikes. Jake Bennett is a big lefty who's going to be competent and throw strikes and help out a Red Sox team at some point, whether it's in long relief or as the ninth starter.
He's
not nearly as exciting.
He's going to give up for the Nationals. Tank.
Probably.
I think Jake Bennett going to give up. Here, ready for an outrageous bold prediction that no one cares about? Jake Bennett allows a 450-foot plus home run in 2026.
I like that. If he does get to the big leagues, that is very possible. Luis Perales is a project, but boy, does he throw hard, and he is fun. I don't know what the Red Sox need Jake Bennett for right now, unless they think they can make him better, throw harder. Are they going to trade some starting pitching for other stuff and need the depth? I don't know. I like the shot for the Nationals.
It's also a sign based off of the trade that they made with, like, they're trying to get Clay is what the Nationals are trying to get. They're trying to get interesting Clay that they can help mold into something. Before we take a break, Scott Boras, no days off. Scobo. It is time for the Scott Boras scoreboard. Jordan, what is his record moment in time?
After getting the dub for the Pete Alonso contract, Scott Boras moved to 7 wins, 2 draws, and 9 losses on the winter. And we've got 2 more contracts and a brand new client joining Boras Corps. Let's begin with the Atlanta Braves signing Ha-Sung Kim to a 1 year, $20 million deal. Kim opted out of the 1 year, $16 million player option that he had. Could have just stayed with the Braves and you know, just saved the paperwork. But no, he was like, you know what? I got Scott Boras. I bet I can get more money than this, and people need shortstops. Turns out maybe only the Braves need a shortstop, but they needed enough to give him $4 million more than they would have on the option, which means that this, I believe, is a pretty easy win for Scott Boras to get more money
than
he would
have
on the option. Very simple. Another $4 million. I will also say in this case, the Braves have been kind of throwing some cash around here. Their payroll is now over the first CBT line of $244 million. We were wondering coming into the offseason, who would be the sixth largest payroll in baseball behind Dodgers, Mets, Blue Jays, Yankees, Phillies? I think this is our answer based on what the Braves have been spending. Mm. And credit to them, because I think, understandably, they think they're going to be pretty good there. So Boras gets a dub for the Ha-Sung Kim contract. He will be their shortstop, and Mauricio Dubon moves to his utility man position. Let's talk about another move, another one-year deal. Again, maybe all these will be bad because one-year deals are bad. The Twins signed Josh Bell. People are like, Josh Bell, Scott Boras? Josh Bell is an OG. All right. Josh Bell has had Boras since he was in high school, getting $5 million out of high school before the draft rules changed. He has been with Boris for a long time. He gets another 1-year deal, $7 million with the Minnesota Twins. And Josh Bell, pretty good this past year for the Nationals. He's a terrible defender, but he's a switch hitter who will help this Twins lineup, who might, if they don't trade anybody, will go into the season next year and be like, you know what? They're not so bad. And I think Josh Bell will help that. But is this a win for Scott Boras, $7 million for Josh Bell? What do you think?
I think this is a draw. I think this is par for the course. If he'd gotten to 10 or gotten 2 years, I would give him a W here. Josh Bell also, again, with like, I don't want to be on the 2026 Twins. Like that.
I'd do it for $7 million.
Maybe for seven. I would do it for $1 million. But you get my point. Like being there in the beginning, like he's going to get traded probably halfway through the year and end up like, yeah. Josh Bell has a playoff RBI next year. Feel pretty good about that.
Love that.
Was surprising he didn't get dealt last year. I mean, he got hot after the break. Yeah. I think that if the Nats were more organized, they could have traded him. So in my mind, this is a draw. That moves Scobo to 8-3-9. And we'll finish with a little bit of news. Mark Vientos, New York Mets for now, infielder, joining Scott Boras. I don't know what agency he was with before, but I care about what agency he is with now. Not, and it is Boras.
Not one with
Corp.
A scoreboard.
Not one with a scoreboard, baby. I would say any active big leaguer leaving their agent to join you is a win. Really, no matter what. Unless the person did like crimes or something. And so that makes this an easy W for Scott Boras. You pick up another client. Is Mark Vientos going to make a ton of money in free agency one day? Probably not. But you know what? You don't have to work that hard. Like if he does, he does. And if he doesn't, whatever. That means that he is 9-3-9. Scratching his way to 500 as we head into the holiday season.
Much more Scobo to come. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to hit the WBC latest news and notes before we say goodbye. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. 3 months from tomorrow is the World Baseball Classic Final. Yes, it is that soon. It is around the corner at the winter meetings. We got a lot of World Baseball Classic nuggets because all of the managers and GMs for the international teams were at the winter meetings. They did a media session and answered questions, the majority of which is, hey, this good major league player, is he going to be in the WBC? And we got some answers, we got some non-answers, but the two main teams where we got a lot of new information was the USA and Team Dominican Republic.
Let's focus on Team USA because we have, of course, wondered how will Team USA, by the way, of course, the defending champs, you know, Samurai Japan, not going to talk about them too much here today. But they're chilling. We're not worried about them. It's all about the teams that are going to try and figure out how to beat Japan. And Team USA and Team DR are, of course, two of the teams near the top of that list with respect to, you know, Venezuela and Mexico, Puerto Rico, and some of the other contenders. We're going to focus on USA and DR today. So let's talk about Team USA, because I don't remember exactly where we were at the last time we talked, but we have a number of more commitments. Of course, the earliest ones being Paul Skeens, being Aaron Judge, being Cal Raleigh.
Yeah.
But the rest of the position player group is starting to take shape. Our outfield now, based on the announced commitments, will now include Corbin Carroll. That is one we expected. Pete Crow Armstrong is in and would seem to be a good pick to be the starting center fielder, even on defense alone, even if he's at the bottom of the lineup. And then the infield, we have Gunnar Henderson and Bryce Terang. Now, Bryce Terang, of course, coming off a really big season with Milwaukee, a really good fit at second base. I know we had speculated when we did this, you know, earlier this season, we're like, okay, could that be Mookie Betts? You know, where is he going to fit into this? Is Mookie even going to be on this team at this point? I don't know. Bryce Terang at second, Gunnar Henderson, who of course would normally be playing shortstop, but it looks like Gunnar Henderson is going to be at third base alongside Bobby Witt Jr. Kyle Schwarber has committed. Will Smith has also committed, which I'd say is at least mildly surprising, although I would imagine with Cal Raleigh on the team, I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, he's not going to catch every inning. If the Mariners are like, yes, you can go play for Team USA, but don't go catch every single inning of the WBC, having another good catcher makes sense. So we have Will Smith there. And then we have a few pitchers being announced. And sorry to disappoint, it is not quite on the level of Paul Skeens, not that anybody is. But we have really the bullpen kind being filled out with Griffin Jacks, another Air Force alum. So that is cool. Garrett Clevenger, a lefty for the Rays, who's a lot better than you think. Garrett Whitlock, another solid reliever. And then Matthew Boyd, who's, of course, coming off an all-star season and is presumably going to be in the rotation. So maybe not the sexy names people are looking for in the rotation. We will see if they can get Logan Webb, who's been reported to be interested. Can they get him to commit from the Giants? What is most interesting you about Team USA right now? Who are the names you're still kind of wondering about moving forward?
So the thing that excites me the most that I think is just super freaking rad is that Corbin Carroll, Pete Crow Armstrong, and Bobby Witt Jr. played together on the 2018 18U team, like the high school national team. Though to have three guys in your starting lineup go from 18U to like the WBC team that have known each other for so long is just so cool. Like that's just so freaking cool. And I think is worth just spending a moment on. And yeah, I mean, it's just the pitching, man. It's just like, what is the pitching going to be? They need another starter that you feel really good about. My problem with Matthew Boyd is, again, what works in the WBC, like we don't have enough of a sample size to like really know. But in my mind, I want, if I'm Team USA, I want guys with stuff, right? Because so many of the hitters that you're facing on some of the lesser teams are not seeing the best stuff in the world all the time, right? Matthew Boyd is not that. I know he's threw harder last year, but like I want another dude with gas starting for me if I can get it. And what that player is just that that's the whole thing. It's not going to be Scooble because he's going to be a free agent. Crochet, there was already a report that he's not going to do it. And so the best pitchers after that are Max Fried.
Well, we don't have Logan Wheeler Webb, now, right? That's not an option.
Zach Wheeler can't do it because he was hurt. Jesus Luzardo, in theory, could do it, but I think he played for Venezuela last time.
Pitched for Venezuela, yeah. Yeah, I don't think
I know, but he's eligible. I think Hunter Brown would be a really good fit.
Yeah, that's a good
that's
one.
That's the guy you probably
want. You think the
Astros
are going to let him go? Like, I don't know about that. We'll see.
Any of the Mariners guys, Brian Wu, Bryce Miller, Logan Gilbert. Yeah.
The Mariners already have like their whole team going to WBC. I don't know if that makes it more or less likely than any of those pitchers. I agree with you.
And then
the guy who
I think ends up on the team, and this is just a total guess, is Joe Ryan. Mm. Joe Ryan played in the Olympics. He was actually traded while he was in the Olympics.
He's still in the minors.
To the Twins. Yeah. What are the Twins going to do? Say, sorry, Joe. Like, at this point, the Twins kind of owe Joe Ryan after trading everyone away.
I agree with that. I think that, again, this is why like I don't even really want to talk about the pitchers because it's just there's going to be so many factors that go into the commits and we're just not going to know until very later. So much later.
But you can usually assume certain guys are not going to go, right? Like if you sign a big free agent deal and it's your first year with a new team like Dylan Cease, I don't think you're going to go. If you're a pitcher like Jacob deGrom who has a wild injury history, I don't think you're
going to
go.
Can you imagine Dylan Cease going to Canada and being like, sorry guys, I got to go pitch for Team USA.
It's awesome. It's awesome.
No, Chris
Sale feels too much of an injury risk.
To me, it's just like the pitchers are going to be such late decisions that it's hard for me to think too hard about it. It's really important. I'm not saying it's not important for the, I'm just saying for where we're at 3 months out, I'm more focused on the position player side. And the last thing I would just say about Team USA is, look, the outfield. I think he's probably done. I think that the outfield is in good shape. I mean, yes, there's other good outfielders. The infield is in good shape. Yes, there's other good shortstops, you know, Corey Seager, whatever. To me, first base is the most interesting, particularly because DH is so locked in with Schwarber. First base is the one where you have really four, like, completely defensible options, and you could argue five, which is Bryce Harper, which is Pete Alonso, which is Nick Kurtz, who we certainly were not considering a year ago, but I think would absolutely have to be in this conversation.
Yeah.
And then Matt Olson's awesome. He's, you know, that's as about as a safe as a bet. And honestly, if all those guys don't do it, Michael Bush would be good option. You know, like Michael Bush is awesome. So how many of those guys do it? Because presumably, and this comes in when we talk about the DR team in a second here, are willing to go if they're not actually going to play, or if they're only going to play a certain amount of times. Like, because you also have to think about it for hitters in particular. It's like they're trying to get ready for the season also. Yes, they want to win this tournament, but if they're going to go and not get at bats, that's not necessarily something they want to sign up for. But I do think that they're going to get more than one of these guys. So, and then where does Pete come in if he just signed with the Orioles? Does he want to, you know, disappear from them?
Pete's not going to do it.
So I don't know.
I know Pete did it last time. I would be surprised if he does it. I think this is going
to
be Bryce.
I think it's also
Bryce really wanted to do it. Bryce really wanted to do it last time, and he was coming off the TJ, I think. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of the reason why he didn't do it. I think it'll be Bryce. I would be surprised if it wasn't. The Braves just feel like a team where they're like, hey, don't do that. Like, I don't know. I just...
Why? It's I don't just know. Like total I have conjecture. No sense. Like, there's some teams seriously are going to have, like, half of their team missing in spring training. But, hey, it's going to be a fun time. All right, let's talk about Team DR before we get out of here. This is, of course, the other team where when you start to see the projected lineups, people are getting really excited. But before
we go into it. Yeah. It is important to remember how bad this went last time. Okay. This was a catastrophe. They didn't make it out of the group stage in 2023. All right.
Yes. People now the group was tough.
On the island.
Yeah, a tough group.
People on the island were not pleased with how this went down.
Now, and you say, okay, well, then what the heck? Who was playing? Well, who was playing last time? Yes, you had Juan Soto. Yes, you had Julio Machado Devers. That was the top of the lineup. You know who else was in the lineup? Eloy Jimenez, Jamer Candelario. Wander Franco was, of course, playing last time. Frankie Mejia was behind the dish. You know, Ketel Marte was batting seventh or eighth. That was probably a mistake. As with the U.S. team, pitching is going to make a big difference here. You know, Sandy Alcantara, you'll have him. Who else pitches? You know, Fromber's a big question mark, of course, coming off free agency. We'll move the pitching to the side. But the positional group is way more interesting because for DR, you have really too many guys for the number of spots you have available. And there have definitely been situations where guys are not going to go if they're not going to play. So the things that I think we know for sure, I do think that there are things that are pretty much set. I think that the outfield is basically indisputable. I think that the outfield right now is going to be Juan Soto in left, Fernando Tatis Jr. in right, and Julio Rodriguez in center. I feel really good about that. I feel really good about Ketel Marte playing second base. I feel really good about Manny Machado playing third base. Now, you can argue that Manny Machado should not be playing third base over Jose Ramirez. I agree. I just think that Machado has been the guy on this team for a long time, and I would expect him to be at third base. And I also think that Yiner Diaz committing, he will be the catcher. Is he a great all-around catcher? No, he is a great option for DR relative to Frankie Mejia, so I expect him to be the high of the plate. We also just, I'm pretty sure, have a confirmation that Vlad Jr. will be at first base. That is important because he pulled out Canadian. Very late last time. He is born in Canada, and I do hope, I was talking to our pals BNS and Shai Davidi about this. I think if Vlad wins it with DR at some point, at the end of his career, he'd go back play for Canada. Oh, I think that would be awesome.
Come on, dude. That's so silly.
That would be great. But anyway, that's not something they actually, I would love to see that. Anyway, so Vlad Jr. playing is important, though, because he pulled out last time, like right before the tournament, because of a minor knee injury. So that's why, you know, Jamer Candelario was playing first base last time. So Vlad at first, that's going to be a lock. So what we're really talking about is shortstop and designated hitter, because boy, do you have a lot of options. Some of which it seems like have committed. Geraldo Perdomo, I believe, another breakout in the Michael Garcia mold. Like, holy crap, did you see how good he was in 2025? He would be a great option. But then you have Ellie De La Cruz. You have Willy Adames, who has been kind of a staple there. You have Jeremy Pena, who, of course, has Dominican heritage and would be absolutely a good candidate to start at shortstop. And then you still have Jose Ramirez and Rafael Devers, who, if they're not playing third base or first base, probably would, you know, certainly deserve to be in the lineup. What is your best guess for how this shakes out here?
As Herb Brooks said in Miracle, I'm not looking for the best players. I'm looking for the right ones. And that's how I feel about the Dominican Republic's WBC team in 2026. I think this ball club, Jordan, needs a couple of guys who can move a runner over, right? Who can get a bunt down, who are willing to take the extra base and aren't just focused on, you know, swinging for the fences. I'm talking about Jorge Polanco. I'm talking about Ramon Laureano, Ahmed Rosario, guys with a little bit of grit, a little dirt under their fingernails. Guys willing to go spikes up high like it's back in the 80s. I think the Dominican Republic, you can't show up with 9 MVP candidates and expect them to play like a team. You know, that's
going to find out.
Okay. That's tough. So if I'm Team DR, I need to make, like, what went wrong last time? You know, you need to make sure you got glue in there. You got glue guys around so that when push comes to shove in tournament baseball, you have guys willing to do whatever it takes. And so I would just put a couple of weird guys on the roster, on the bench. Like, I wouldn't, now I'm going to switch back to my actual voice. If you're going to start 9 dudes, I would have Perdomo at short and Cattell at second, right? That's how I would roll it out in starting lineup. My bench, though, would be a bench. Like, I would not try and shoehorn non-bench guys onto my bench. Like, I would do maybe 1 or 2. I would probably want Caminero on my bench, maybe Devers. But like,
yeah, Caminero's the name I didn't mention, that he'll be on the team for sure.
Like, I think it's totally reasonable to, you want players playing roles that they're familiar with, that they're used to playing, right? And like, asking someone who doesn't pinch hit a lot to go pinch hit in a big spot, I think that there's something to that. Again, maybe I sound curmudgeon-y and you should just put all the good players on the team and hope you get that works. That's a defensible strategy. I just think that what was missing from this team last time was someone to keep things together, based upon my understanding.
I would say they had too many bad players on the team last time, more than what you're describing. Mm. I also think that everything you're describing is true about Team USA as well.
I agree. So 100%.
Yeah. Like, I don't think this is just a DR thing, and I have to imagine that that's part
yes
of
it. Yes, and yeah, but you're right. But the difference is Team USA was one Mike Trout swing away from winning the whole thing, and Team DR.
No, like, I know, but I'm just saying that.
Like, if you want to be a hardo, you can describe USA's last tournament as a failure. Sure. But it wasn't a catastrophe.
Well, I'm not even saying that's why they lost. I'm just saying, like, when we're talking about the team right now and the next guys that are going to be on the team, all the same premise applies to how they build.
I also think that, again, it's all about the pitching. Which pitching shows up will determine who wins, and we will talk about that when the time comes. I think that the Dominican is the third best team and is in the top tier of teams. Like, it is in my them, USA, and Japan, that is the upper crust. Depending on who Venezuela is able to get, will maybe propel them into that conversation. The problem is they have a lot of TBDs on that roster. Japan, we do know for a fact that Otani and Yamamoto are in, probably no Roki, but having Otani Yamamoto is a huge deal. Otani probably not going to pitch, understandably, but Yamamoto will, that's for sure.
Yeah, and again, we will have to do a full deep dive on Team Japan as we get closer, and we'll bring Yuri back on for that. But But dude, some, like, again, Puerto Rico is going to have a lot of good players. Mexico is going to have a lot of good players. Like, it is not Canada, at least on offense, is going to have a lot of good players. So there will be some very, very fun teams to watch in this. And we will talk about it more and more as it approaches. All right, we're done. We've gone very long. Thank you all for listening to this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing. As always, you can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Jake Mintz, final word?
I need to go watch the Buffalo Sabres introduce new general manager Jarmo Kekalainen. For those of you who've been listening for a while, you know Jordan and I are diehard Buffalo Sabres fans. And it's a big day in Buffalo.
Jarmo, we trust. In Jarmo,
new GM,
we trust. New GM, take us to the promised land, Jarmo! AKA out of last place. Wow, what a reference! Goodbye, everybody. We will talk to you on Friday.